And it's perfect for tonight's guest, the very patient Peter von Puttkamer, if we will talk about his exploits overseeing the Monster Hunters, just one of the many documentaries he works on. Great work. Want to hear his latest coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Hard to name a network that has not shown material from Peter von Puttkamer and the work that you've done over the last couple of years. Peter, for those people who may not see your resume as completely as I do, other than Monster Hunters, why don't you go over some of your better-known titles?
Sure. Hi, how you doing? I think the audience on your show would no doubt be familiar with Sasquatch Odyssey, A Hunt for Bigfoot, which has sort of become a bit of a classic now because featured the four old-time hunters of Bigfoot, Peter Byrne, Grover Krantz, Rene de Hinden, and John Green. And sadly, two of those gentlemen have since died since we did the show. But it's a great testament to those guys, and it's a lot of fun, and looks at Bigfoot culture, and you know, examines the whole phenomenon.
Kind of the original four horsemen of the Sasquatch apocalypse.
Well, they're kind of loosely referred to as that by a couple of people in the show. Yeah. The four horsemen of Sasquatchery. But that was, bit of a early work on, you know, Bigfoot. Sure. Out there. I've been making films for 25 years, and my films, you know, go back into the early 80s, and I'm working with Native Americans, producing shows for PBS, working with Native American filmmakers in partnerships, and creating some pretty important work in terms of their communities and cultural and spiritual practices. One of my early films is called Spirit of the Mask, which is on Northwest Coast masks and the connection between human being masks, the spirit world, and nature.
I love that.
And it was actually through that I ended up getting into, my fascination with Bigfoot and Wild Man and those characters, which I saw showing up in the Native ceremonies, in the potlatch ceremonies of the Pacific Northwest, where I'd actually see Bigfoot appearing, represented in a full hair costume in a firelit longhouse.
Mm. You can say then, you've been a filmmaker for so long, you actually go back to the times when you were making things with film.
That's right. I actually trained on film. Right. Now, of course, we're totally digital. We're high definition. Recent production, people might have seen, it was called The Real Lost World. We went on a hunt for Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World in Venezuela.
Oh, that's right.
And we scaled a 9,000-foot plateau, and we took... had 50 Pomone Indian porters to get us to the top, and cast and crew of 20, and it was a major production and really led to some exciting adventures and really the first connection ever. We were actually able to show how the not just legends but sightings by Native Indian people in the region of flying reptiles, dragons, they called them dragons, coming off the top of the mountain, and ape men in each village that we went to had different stories about a Bigfoot-like creature in Venezuela.
That's amazing.
And this was the first time anyone has connected, these stories, which got to the British explorers, which they brought back to England. Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes,
sure,
you know, is sitting in the lecture hall listening to this stuff, and his mind is ticking away, and he comes up with the first fantasy adventure book of its kind ever. I mean, it launched, the whole genre of dinosaurs and people, and King Kong, for example, came out of it. Ultimately, Jurassic Park came out of it, and I wanted to show that it all came from this one place, and that's what we did, and we found other interesting things along the way as well.
Yeah, and you've been there, which is the neat part, too. then, because it's not just that, you've got a variety of these documentaries which takes you into various jungles and otherwise kind of scary places on the planet. And you've been to all these places. So let me ask you, what in your experience isn't possible? When you hear these stories and you've been to these places, have you been able to eliminate from your worldview things that you don't think are true?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when we did Monster Hunters, I kind of went out to look for, I mean, the whole realm of cryptozoology, it takes you from, like you say, the credible terrestrial or marine creatures to animals that should be extinct but maybe aren't, brand new species, and then you get into the realm of the supernatural and the demonic. And probably, you know, when dealing with something, we dealt with the Jersey Devil, and not a lot of cryptozoological shows have dealt with the Jersey Devil, possibly because it does seem so outlandish. And yet, next to Bigfoot, it's America's best-known monster. And there's a national hockey team named after the Jersey Devil.
True.
The Air National Guard in New Jersey has a Jersey Devil as its official mascot insignia. It's a pretty intriguing phenomenon. And that place, the Pine Barrens, of all the places I've been to, also qualifies as the scariest place I've been to.
I've driven through the Pine Barrens a couple of times, and I was very interested in your doc on the Jersey Devil, partly because, and I think, although I didn't, I saw most of it. I don't know that I got to the very end, but there were, I thought, many more versions about the supposed origin of the Jersey Devil. There was one very specific one, which you offered, about the Leeds family, and I'd love to have you tell that story. But there are a couple others out there of how the Jersey Devil supposedly started. And in a way, the some of the stories predated the arrival of white people into that part of the country.
Yeah, we kind of alluded to that. I mean, the thing about it is that it's easy because of the description of the Jersey Devil is basically a, you know, 250-year-old bat-winged, cloven-hoofed, horned, tail demon that's pretty well fits our description of the devil in many ways. And so you tend to think, well, the Puritan, you know, Puritans who inhabited that part of the country in, you know, in the 1600s and 1700s, they cooked this thing up. But as you say, there's stories going back to Native American references to the place as the dragon's place. They called this creature the horned one. And that preceded white men getting there.
And I think that's interesting to me more than the cautionary tale of the Leeds family, where it's the mother who's been pregnant for the 12th time or whatever, and instead of feeling like it's a blessing, she curses the child and it comes out a demon.
Yeah,
attacks her, attacks the parents, then jumps out the window and becomes the Jersey Devil, which seems much more like a typical puritanical apocryphal story,
right,
to warn you against not treating every child like a blessing, or what happens if you have a birth defect, that it's of the devil or something. I mean,
what always appealed to me, like of all the different monsters that we, you know, covered in the miniseries, both the Chupacabra and the Jersey Devil, I kind of, in my own mind, started working out some possible explanations for it. And then there's always a bit of a mystery note at the end of the day. But, you know, with the Jersey Devil, for example, you know, you said the deformed child. Well, there are tales of, you know, this Leeds family actually having had a deformed child that was locked in an attic, that the child would only come out very, very occasionally, and if it was, it was covered in this black cape. And so hence the wings, the black wings, and from the legend. And if you, in those days, if you had a child that was deformed, the woman, you know, could have been said to have been conspiring with the devil. And I think that's a really good place to start with the legend of where this might have come from. But that's the legend. It's the biological creature that people have been citing and continue to cite to this day. You know, all through the 1800s, leading up to Phenomenal Week in 1909, where people across three states saw it, policemen shot at it, trolley cars in New Jersey, you know, people sighted this thing flying by trolley cars pretty well. Pretty soon they had armed shotgun riders on trolley cars in Philadelphia.
What year was that?
1909.
Yeah.
And there's even a very detailed account from a fire department who had the Jersey Devil in broad daylight trapped on the roof of a house and was using fire hoses to
right.
hose it down.
Right.
And in a kind of Ray Harryhausen movie moment, the water runs out and the Jersey Devil leaps down and they're throwing sticks and stones at it. And it's so detailed, and it's an official report by a fire department, you know, in the modern era, the 20th century, and you're thinking, well, what the heck is this thing, and why would city officials bother to make such a such a report?
Well, and it pushes the idea of it being something which is cryptozoological as opposed to demonic.
Yeah.
That maybe that we're talking about here is some untyped species, and that it is different than a cursed, deformed child, which always still comes back down to, again, sort of this archaic way that people looked at birth defects.
Right.
As, you know, somehow that this was a result of the sin of the parents or some such.
Yeah.
And I do think that's interesting, although the always associated with this Jersey Devil is a kind of human-like intelligence or a super intelligence for an animal, a kind of sentience which is, you know, bespeaks awareness of what's going on around it.
Yes. Well, I just want to add, similarly to the chupacabra, you have a perfect environment for the legend of such a monster to exist. I mean, when you go to the Pine Barrens, and especially if you go out at night, as we did with a group of monster hunters, you're walking through essentially trails and back roads from, you know, revolutionary days in America. I mean, you can actually see actual roads from the 1800s, like dusty, gravelly paths that were once driven on by stagecoaches and that. It's a fantastic place. And as you're walking through the woods, you come across family plots and graves,
yeah,
and forgotten towns from the 1840s.
Right.
This area was once industrial heartland of America before the steel towns of the north kicked in. So you had terracotta factories and glass factories and a major cranberry harvest there.
Sure.
So as you come into these little ghost towns in the middle of the night with moonlight streaking in through the trees, sometimes you find animal bones scattered in an apparent sacrifice on the ground. You find satanic drawings on the walls, and all the while you're looking for the birth house, where the baby was born. Said to be the place where the Jersey Devil gets its power.
Right.
And there's a lot of theories about where the birth house is and if it burned down. And that's the quest we were on with the monster hunters and something people still believe in.
To find the physical evidence, the environmental evidence of the Jersey Devil. And for people who have never been to the Pine Barrens, there's something about the repetition and the density of the Pine Barrens,
yes,
that leads you to this sense of creepiness that you said was probably the worst you'd had of any of your travels.
Well, and, And there's one other element I forgot, and that's the cicadas. And the,
oh, yeah.
The background the noise is
right.
is louder than the Amazon.
It's, yeah, the ambient noise of the Pine Barrens.
It's the split second the sun drops beneath the horizon, it starts up on a scale of, 10, it's like about 7. So you've got this piercing, vibrating noise kind of pounding in your head as you're going through, and it's very, very dark because the woods are dense, and you've got graves popping up, and there's a definite feeling of creepiness when you're there. And like I said, the sightings continue, and the other fascinating part is that there are people that live in the Pine Barrens. They're referred to as the Pineys. They don't like that name especially. They're the original inhabitants, some of Scots Irish heritage, others said to be descended from Hessian mercenaries who fought in the Revolutionary Wars. And this story is their story in a lot of ways. And the people that we interviewed in our film, and not many people have interviewed the Pineys before about the Jersey Devil, and we did, and we even took part in a guitar jamboree, and it was a fantastic experience. And they describe a sound like a woman being torn apart in the swamps, and a sound so loud that they would come out at night with their guns loaded because they didn't know what the heck was going on. And the lady we talked to also cited a Jersey Devil flying over the trees. And, I asked her, was it a vulture? And she said, "That's an old buzzard. I know a buzzard when I see one."
Yeah. And I think that's an interesting, I think that's a really point that should be pushed, too, is that there's something about the disparate. I mean, again, I'm pulling on my travels through the Pine Barrens myself, and there is almost there's a horizon line at the tree level, which is truly just marks between light and dark. I mean, you have the sky up above, which is bright, and then once you get below that tree line, it is really dark.
That's there. It. You're right. It's really dark.
And so you really would notice something above the tree line. It would really stand below the tree line. Something could easily blend into that forest. But if it goes above the tree line, I mean, it would be like backlighting something so dramatically compared to what you would see underneath it.
Yeah. And there were just so many interesting elements to the story, and we really pursued it. We even had quite an amusing encounter with a local member of the SPCA who told us that at one point in the history of the Pine Barrens, people were releasing emus into the woods. Emus kept as exotic pets or on farms were being released into the Pine Barrens and could be an explanation for the Jersey Devil.
Except emus don't fly, right?
Right.
They're flightless fowl.
But imagine staggering through the Pine Barrens one late moonlit night and coming across a 6-foot-high bird.
Yes.
Looking like a dinosaur.
Looking like it was going to peck your face off as you came around the corner. Well, excellent. Well, let's leave it there for the time being. We'll come back. Peter von Puttkamer, the auteur of decades worth of documentaries out on the fringes. And we'll talk a little bit, too, about some of his work in the Native American cultures. Fascinating stuff dealing with some of the hallucinogenics and some of the history of drugs. And also, I want to pick at the Chupacabra and the Yowies next as we continue our conversation. And we'll open up the phones next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. I meant to tell you, if you missed crypto news earlier, you can catch it right now on the website at coasttocoastam.com. Just go there and click on to where it said read Ian Punnett's blog. You go from there, and it'll take you right to the website with all the crypto news stories. But we just talk about them. That's it. Peter von Puttkamer lives them. Crypto news with his research into cryptozoology, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. His series, The Monster Hunters, tracking six groups of people on a mission to find physical evidence of some of the most sought-after creatures, be they human or not, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Of all of the creatures that you went searching for in your Monster Hunter series, by the way, did that run on Discovery? Is that where that ran?
Yes, TLC.
Right, TLC.
Yeah.
Of all of the creatures, the one I think I know the least about, or the one that I've only heard about more than read about, is the Yowie. Yes. That's the one that's sort of the Bigfoot cousin in Australia, isn't it?
That's right. And actually, you can read quite a bit about it at YowieHunters.com. This is my friend Dean Harrison runs a group over there called the Yowie Hunters Australian Yowie Research. And they go on some pretty amazing expeditions there, full-blown trips into the not just the outback, but the bush, the deep jungle in Queensland, and also we were in the mountainous area outside of Sydney, known as the Blue Mountains. And what was quite unusual about the Yowie, with Bigfoot, there are hardcore Bigfoot enthusiasts and you get eyewitnesses, but in general, people are pretty shy about coming forward, and they're kind of embarrassed about it, or they're worried about their jobs. And in the case of the Yowie, we found an entire community that all had regular sightings of an 8-foot hairy ape man running around in the woods behind their houses. We talked to several different people, including school teachers, ex-naval people, and they all describe this thing in great detail. In the case of the one family, it was almost like Harry and the Hendersons. This thing would make regular visits, and they'd leave food for it.
What were they feeding a Yowie?
I think they were leaving, I'm pretty sure they were leaving hot dogs.
Hot dogs. here's what interests me about what I know about the Yowie, and the only piece of this that always stuck out to me sort of a little bit sideways from the reports of Bigfoot or Yeti, is that there are stories of Native Australian stories, Aboriginal stories, of them having battles with the Yowie, that there was a time when the Yowie were kind of a separate species. And I've never heard of Bigfoot battles where there's, 100 Bigfoot on one side and, American settlers on the other, but that apparently the Aborigines have, as part of their group memory, these legends of decisive battles between Yowies and themselves that may have decided who continued to evolve and who kind of ran aground, on the Darwinian evolution scale.
Yeah. Well, I know, one big difference between Yowie and Bigfoot in general, other than a few cases where you hear of, I think there was once a battle we reported in Sasquatch Odyssey between a group of miners in a cabin near Mount St. Helens. And there was an all-night battle with guns being fired out of a cabin, and the Sasquatch is throwing large boulders onto the cabin. But in general, they're not that mean. But in Australia, they're actually quite feared, and it may go back to that Yowie tradition, as you say, with the Aborigines. They found headless bodies in the wilderness and this sort of thing, and things that have been attributed to Yowies. Even animals, large livestock actually found hanging up in trees, dead,
right,
and partially eaten, and right, this sort of thing.
And that makes you feel more like the Yowie. if they exist, and I'm willing to go with you on this, are much more of a Cro-Magnon-like kind of species of hominid than, say, Bigfoot, which has traditionally always leaned toward a more animal-like interpretation.
Well, I mean, there's always the two camps, right? We got into that in Sasquatch Odyssey quite a bit because the four Bigfoot hunters all discuss, is it ape, is it human? People like Dean still believe that the Yowie is descendant from Gigantopithecus, this large, 10-foot ape-like creature, which, bones have been found only 300,000 years old, which isn't that old, in China. And so it's believed that this could be Gigantopithecus. But, as you say, with the caveman idea, I mean, the whole idea of wild men and why wild men exist in cultures all over the world, one of the theories, sort of like dragons and why dragons are in our memory in every culture in the world, is that it coexisted with other, primitive human species at one point. And certainly, we're a lot closer to Cro-Magnon than we are to Neanderthal, and the idea is that Neanderthal may be that other hairy human.
Right.
That was out there coexisting with Cro-Magnon for 60,000 years.
Right. But whether it's whoever it is, that aboriginal story, that self-defining story, mm-hmm. of the aborigines, that they were the victors, even if it is exaggerated that it came down to one decisive battle, where it was all the technology of the aborigines versus the hand-to-hand stone weapons of the of whoever it is that comprised the Yowie, that it somehow goes to, even if it's a microcosm of the truth, it sort of goes to this idea that at one time it was Homo sapiens versus, Homo deadendus, where they just, as a species, lost. And that it comes down to us through this story of this titanic battle between the aborigines and the Yowies.
Sure. You never know. It could be. I will say, as frightening as the Jersey Devil Pine Barrens woods were, walking around at night, I'd done some research on snakes in Australia, and I think people generally know that 7 out of 10 of the deadliest snakes in the world are in Australia.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I found out, I was, they were saying, well, you won't really encounter snakes unless you find yourself, wandering around the woods at night. And of course, that's all we were going to be doing on Monster Hunters, is wandering around the woods at night.
Right.
And so we knew there were these eastern brown snakes and these deadly, very toxic snakes that were going to be out there, venomous. And but what we hadn't counted on were the land leeches. And the old world, so in Asia and Australia, unlike here and in South America, where leeches are confined to the water, more or less, in Australia, especially Tasmania, if you're in the woods there and you stop, you'll hear this kind of rustling sound, and there'll be armies of leeches heading for you. And at first they kind of...
Armies of leeches?
Yeah.
Marching where? On the floor of the jungle?
They know anything that stops in the woods gets attacked by the leeches. And you got to keep moving pretty well all the time. And I did a show on Tasmanian devils there, and the poor Tasmanian devils, they were live trapping them, and whenever they got to them, they were all covered in these leeches. And for humans, as I discovered, wandering around, and I had my big, tall snake boots on and all this, but I hadn't counted on a tiny crack in the sort of the tongue of the leather boot, and this leech was attached to my leg, and it was the size of about a 4-inch garden slug.
Get out.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And it was at night, so pitch black, of course, because the Yowie hunters only work in pitch black with little diamond lights on their collars, and they just signal silently to each other because the Yowie will take off with any sound. And they play kind of games of cat and mouse with the Yowie, and it will throw things at them and throw rocks and huge boulders and things at them. And so we're out there, and I noticed this thing on my kind of slimy thing on my leg, and I put my headlamp down, and there's this massive leech.
Ugh.
And I just touch it, and it drops to the ground and takes off kind of like the thing in Alien at great speed. Like, it's like zooming along the ground, and I'm running after it. Come back with my blood, you know. I'm
yeah, really.
Stomp on it, you know.
Oh, I'll be darned. It sounds like the scene with the insects in the remake of King Kong, right, where they fall down into that valley and all of these giant insects come out.
That's right.
Attack them. Oh, that's amazing. Well, let me go back to the Yowie thing, though, because you said something. And again, Yowies I know least about. So without having seen the Monster Hunter episode on them, thank you for giving us a little bit more information about it. You said the Yowies are sensitive to sound, that they'll run away at the slightest sound.
Yeah.
What's the closest anybody's come to having any sort of documentary evidence, like a photograph, a recording, anything like that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, if you go to Dean's site, yowiehunters.com, you're going to see a lot of footprint evidence and that sort of thing. But, you know, kind of like, you know, Bigfoot, I mean, the actual image, other than the Patterson film, remains elusive.
Right. And, but, I mean, is there any Patterson-Gimlin film of this, of his own?
There is not.
Okay.
There has not been a really definitive film shot on it.
How about Native American artwork, much like we see in the Northwest with Bigfoot?
You know something, I've done so much work with indigenous people all over the world, in South America and in Indonesia and in all over with Native Americans, First Nations in Canada. And the Aboriginal people are very, very secretive about the Yowie. And if we'd had more time and several months, I think I could have possibly infiltrated secret societies over there to talk about it. But in general, based on my research and Dean, who spent his whole life in Australia, that it's very hard to get them to talk about it. And it's a little bit like, you know, some of the legends of the Northwest Coast, and people are, you know, they're sacred spirit beings and they don't talk about them.
Well, and speaking of sacred and these spirit beings, I was very interested in the documentary you did about peyote.
Yes.
And I watched that. I've never been a drug taker, or for that matter, even a drinker. So I've known people who have done these types of sweat lodge hallucinogenic experiences. Mm-hmm. And they talk about it as sort of life altering. And the ways in which your documentary worked on that, I thought were consistent with what some of my friends had been through. And I don't know. I just wonder, whether did you go through it too as the filmmaker, or did you merely observe it as it was being?
Well,
done?
No. I mean, I was much too busy making my film to be taking any hallucinogenic plants, but. You know, we were able to film, you know, the native ceremonies in progress. And of course we don't just look at peyote, but we're looking at the story of how hallucinogenic plants, came through the native peoples of the Americas, through this one ethnobotanist, this Richard Evans Schultes, who's been called the greatest plant explorer of the 20th century, and he's found like 2,000 plants previously unknown, and among them are, you know, poisons, medicines, hallucinogens, and he inadvertently became a father of the psychedelic era. This is a two-hour special for the History Channel. It's going to be on April 20th. And
so that hasn't run anywhere yet.
No, it's brand new.
It's really interesting.
It's my latest production, and my friend Wade Davis is the star of it. He's a National Geographic explorer in residence, and people might know him from his book called The Serpent and the Rainbow.
Oh, sure, right? Oh, that was him. Oh, yeah, I didn't realize it. That's the same guy who started the reinvestigation of the whole voodoo thing.
Well, Wade, basically, as a young man, was sent to Haiti by Richard Schultes, actually, to uncover the basis for how zombieism, how zombies are made.
Right.
And he solves the puzzle, like, through, you know, these plants and poisons and medicines. They come up with this concoction that brings people to a near-death state. And the book, Serpent in the Rainbow, became
a famous
cult classic now. Wes Craven.
Martin Sheen.
Bill Pullman. Bill Pullman plays, he basically plays Wade. So Wade.
Wait. I thought that book also inspired the Martin Sheen movie where he was dealing with a voodoo cult who was creating zombies too.
That's possible.
I didn't see the Bill Pullman movie. I like him a lot.
Serpent in the Rainbow is a Universal Pictures release. Okay. And in any case, so Wade's traveled the world, and as an ethnobotanist has ingested a lot of these hallucinogens with the native people as part of his job as a Harvard professor, and our purpose of our show was really, it's like an untold story of the psychedelic era. Like, how did this stuff come to the West? And while Richard Schultes is out in the jungle finding these hallucinogens, often by accident, a man named Dr. Albert Hoffman is in Switzerland, also using a natural substance, mold from rye, ergot mold from rye, and he creates LSD. In 1938, he first discovers it and then accidentally absorbs some through his skin in the 40s and takes a bicycle ride home in the first LSD trip in the 1940s. Mm. And so we kind of parallel the story of the man in the jungle working with native people.
Sure.
And this story of the man in the laboratory and how it really, long before the hippie generation, it was poets, intellectuals, people like Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World, people like Robert Graves, who wrote I, Claudius. These were the people experimenting with hallucinogens. It was not something a bunch of deadbeats did. It was really believed to be something that could transform society. And that's part of what we wanted to show. And of course, when Timothy Leary got a hold of it and dropped it wholesale onto an unsuspecting America, and what we tried to show in our film is that if you have a shamanic guide and you're going through this process with a person that can actually tell you what's going on, and you're doing it for a specific reason, and you're in a quiet environment, it's not particularly harmful. In fact, it could be quite beneficial. But what happened in the 60s is you had a lot of kids taking hallucinogens without any guide, without any proper setting, and all heck broke loose.
Yep. And you need the road man, as you talk about him in the documentary, the person who is the guide. Well, hang on to that. We'll come back to it. And we'll give the numbers for other people to join the conversation we're having with Peter von Puttkamer as we're talking about his documentary series, Monster Hunters, and more. And I'll throw this question out to you now, Peter, kick it around for a second. Of all the things you investigated, what do you think absolutely for sure exists? Of all of the cryptozoological creatures, whatever, what do you know absolutely for sure exists? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.